The views expressed in this interview are those of the individuals and do not reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, or the Naval Postgraduate School. Welcome to the Trident Room, brewer of stout conversation, unfiltered and on tap.
Part two of the two-part episode.
Welcome back to the Trident Room podcast. Your hosts today are Lieutenant Commander Colleen Wilmington and Lieutenant Tony Castillo. Today we have the distinct honor to learn from Admiral Cecil Haney, retired United States Navy, who is on campus to inspire our winter 2025 graduates at commencement tomorrow. Admiral Haney is the former commander of U.S. Strategic Command and U.S. Pacific Fleet. And if you didn't know about his history, here it is. Admiral Haney retired from the U.S. Navy in 2017 after 38 years of distinguished service. He began his career in 1974 at the Naval Academy and upon graduation with a degree in ocean engineering, became a submarine officer. He completed operational assignments on USS John C. Calhoun, USS Frank Cable, USS Hyman G. Rickover, USS Asheville, and Submarine Squadron 8, ultimately commanding the fast-attack nuclear submarine USS Honolulu, Submarine Squadron 1, and Submarine Group 2. Admiral Haney also served on the staff of the Chief of Naval Operations as the Director of Submarine Warfare and the Director of the Naval Warfare Integration Group. He rose to the rank of four-star admiral as commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet in 2012, and then to his culminating assignment as Commander United States Strategic Command in 2013, where he was responsible for all U.S. nuclear weapons, missile defense, space, and cyberspace. He serves on various academic, industry, and nonprofit boards, including John Hopkins Applied Physics, Penn State Applied Research Lab, the USNA and Naval Postgraduate School Foundations, the Aerospace Corporation, General Dynamics, Tenet Healthcare, Systems Planning and Analysis Incorporated, the Center for a New American Security, and as chairman of the board for the Military Child Education Coalition and the Hillendale Baptist Church. Admiral Haney earned his own master degree from the Naval Postgraduate School in 1987 with distinction. He was the first African-American NPS graduate to achieve the rank of four-star admiral and is an inductee to the NPS Hall of Fame.
With the power of our submarines and their global capabilities, how have you prepared for possible decision struggle? Whether do I make the decision that could do this massive change? How have you maintained mental clarity and moral responsibility through those decisions?
It's been interesting, and I've enjoyed thoroughly in the submarine community, is the extensive training we've always had and the sophisticated trainers that we were able to do it in. As a two crew operator on the first submarine I was on, that was a ballistic missile strategic deterrence kind of platform. When we were not even with the submarine, we were training in these trainers to ensure we could decode messages, verify the messages were truly from the National Command Authority and what have you, and then be able to carry it out fully, because you don't have a credible deterrence if you don't have that capability. But at the same time, having that responsibility that you're not going to act without having the command and control correct messages and what have you in order to carry out the mission there. Same thing for the fast attack submarines. We went through sophisticated trainers in that regard so that we could practice our skill sets of the variety of missions, whether it was anti-ship, land attack, to anti-submarine, and reconnaissance kind of operation, what have you. We got to practice that, not just trained, but graded on in those areas to give us the confidence and trust we would not only know how to operate, but also to practice that command and control piece associated with what we were to do in that regard. And that went through every stage of my growing up in that regard, from a basic junior officer all the way up to department head school, to XO school, to commanding officer school, in that regard of the training standards are rigorous in that regard, both from the warfighting, the operational side, to the nuclear propulsion plant side of things.
For the submarine doctrine, is there a historical parallel that you think exists within the world that you've seen beforehand, maybe some of the Greeks did or the Romans, that, like, you know, we've evolved the doctrine from something that we've seen in the past?
Well, you must, though, reflect the big business that really drew submarine capability up was World War II, in our entry, when Pearl Harbor was bombed. And the fleet, with the exception of the aircraft carriers, because they were out at sea, those battleships were decimated and what have you in port. So Admiral Nimitz had to, you know, push the submarines out. And at the time frame, you know, some of the weapons weren't so good at the time frame. Some of the torpedoes would circle back. But getting those improvements inculcated so that the submarines could take that fight forward was something that became a trend, because before that, there was a lot of escorting, pilot pickup, those kind of things that submarine duties were. But in this case, reality required those submarines to be able to carry that fight forward in a big way. So I didn't go back to pre all of that, because from my standpoint, that was really the genesis of how our submarines operate, with the capabilities they have, advanced capabilities today, but that still crew warfighting spirit is what makes our submarines force a formidable force today.
For the audience, if anyone's really interested in that, and thank you, sir, for that. Looking at how we managed to sink the convoy, or sink the merchant ships for Japan, which really forced them to limit what they're able to use for fuel, things like that. And so World War II, as you mentioned, sir, is really a testbed for a lot of what we've seen in regards to not necessarily attacking the ships per se, warships, but another avenue or another friction point, if you will, to force a nation to come to terms for whatever we propose to the opposite side. With that being said, is there another opportunity to use something similar tactics if we were to have some sort of friction point with China over Taiwan, and how do you think that would go?
Well, I think when you look at war fighting today, as much as I'm a big fan of the underwater sport and what submarines, it is our combined joint capabilities that make a difference in the deterrence in terms of things. Everything from strategic deterrence in terms of our nuclear weapons arsenal and our ability to command and control that, all the way down to our tactical units and the proficiency across the board, to include even our space and cyberspace capabilities, in addition to, you know, the Navy platforms that provide a face forward. But it is our joint military capability and our ability to execute operations together in a multifaceted manner that not only wins the day, but deters wars from starting in the first place.
Speaking of deterrence, sir, we've talked about our submarines being the mobile arm of a nuclear deterrence strategy, but most of that strategy has remained unchanged since the Cold War. But reality has changed. The world has changed. If you could redesign our deterrence strategy from the ground up, what would you change?
Well, the basic of deterrence, though, has not changed, I would argue. And that is you want to make sure you have the capabilities such that the other nations, a nuclear armed nation, would understand that today is not the day to use that capability, because you won't achieve the results you want, and it will be extremely costly to you, because we have the inherent capability to strike back if so ordered. And that piece requires a very sophisticated, connected strategic deterrent force. And while we have a preponderance of those warheads, et cetera, you know, the patrols that go on each day, sight unseen and what have you, ensure that adversary knows that we are at the ready all the time in that regard, in addition to our other two legs of the triad. Now, what you see more focus on today is a bit more in terms of, should we have advertised a bit like tactical nuclear weapon capabilities, such as the sea launch cruise missile, in terms of things? I argue, quite frankly, that if a nuclear weapon goes bomb, regardless of its warhead size, it's going to have a strategic effect going forward. So we can't cloud the business in terms of what's strategic and what's not. But I am a fan that you have to have capability across the board. Now, that capability is not necessarily new. We had it back when I was a younger pup in the business. So the business of having something like that in our arsenal not only deters, but it also provides perhaps an even more credible, sure deterrence to our allies' partners in that regard.
Where do autonomous systems fit into all of this?
Well, autonomous systems have what I call a significant capability in combat in general, in addition to the business of first understanding the battlefield from an intelligence, reconnaissance, surveillance standpoint, to the business of having armed capabilities such as armed drones that can in fact make any adversary have to think more about whether or not they're going to either go to war or their ability to move about freely without expecting things. I think we've seen more recent true examples of that in the Ukraine conflict. But with it, you know, this is stuff that, in my opinion, we, the United States military, has also been studying and developing capability for some time. And we can't just look at this as what are lessons out of Ukraine. We have to use that, but we have to be better than that as we look on some of our sophisticated competitors. If you look at China, a conflict with them, or pressure for that case in terms of things, and even Iran. So they have a role to play, and they can enhance our warfighting capability, particularly depending on their attributes. If they are expendable, it may be better for that to get expended and attacked than a manned platform, for example, in certain scenarios in that regard. But you have to be careful that you have the correct command and control element associated with unmanned capability so that it's not doing something you want to turn off or what have you, because you don't have, you know, that has to be ingrained into what you're trying to do.
With placing more of an onus now on individuals to manage autonomous systems, vice managing people themselves, do you think there should be a shift or a change in perhaps how we teach ethical frameworks to start thinking more about how do we conduct warfare and maybe what philosophically we've done in the past and how we should apply it moving forward?
Yeah, I think you have to have seminars and discussions associated with that kind of thing. And where does it apply and where does it doesn't apply? You know, and it's even in combat without unmanned systems, you've got to have an area defined that you can attack. What can you attack in it, even if you got people involved? No different if you've got autonomous systems, they got to be able to do that. So the next derivative is where a lot of the debate comes into how far can you grant that autonomous capability to go in and attack X, Y, or Z. It's one thing to have autonomous systems doing surveillance, for example, and it decides, boy, if you had the smarts in it, to say, boy, I've got a sniff of this over here. I need to move in this direction. I'm not violating perhaps that country's borders and doing it. And you have all that figured out in it. That's a little different than when you are, you're applying some attack criteria associated with it. But as I say, I believe the future of warfare will require it in some situations that you will need. I gave you that candid laser example, but I believe, you know, land combat, what have you, will have to be able to say, boy, I've got all the right indications. It's time to take these three things out. You may need the permission of the operator to say, go in independent operations in this particular quadrant, but, you know, it will morph into being, I think, a way of war that we'll have to get into. I'm not opposed to the fact that as we progress better and better with things, there will be certain things that you may want that unmanned drone or what have you to think, and it has a adversary signal over there. You've got Marines that are going into that territory. You need to take it out instead of having, you know, a lot of back and forth. You ought to just take it out in that regard. I have a harder time envisioning that kind of decision-making in nuclear capability. I think you have to keep that human in the loop. You may be using artificial intelligence and machine learning and those kind of things to get the intelligence and understand the battle space and what have you in a better way. But be able to say, we're just going to have our nuclear missiles to launch without a human, you know, you may get those sensing wrong or something. And it's very important to be able to have that ability because of the consequences associated with that. But in some combat, particularly tactical situations, I think we're going to have to get that way, or we won't be fast enough. I think sometimes in the cyber world, we are going to have to be that way in order to stop the attacks and those kind of things.
Do you think that there are any issues that we may have with military culture, recruiting, readiness, our advancement of implementing autonomous systems or including them, that some people may not agree with the use of them in warfare? How do we continue to build our force as we help them with their values?
I think, quite frankly, with the younger folks of America, they and their video games and what have you, it's not as abnormal to them. They, I think, will thrive in that regard. I think in some cases, the older generation will have more of a problem in terms of getting to the point of thinking about how we have to do that sort of thing. You know, that's different. If you have 10 UAVs that are armed coming your way as a swarm, you need your perhaps laser system to, once you say attack, to figure out the best combination of that attack because of various characteristics. This one's going faster, it's closer, or what have you, to take them out without you as a man in the loop directing each individual case. But you got to make sure it's an adversary capability. You can't do what I think it was Vincent some time ago that shot at an airliner. In that regard, you got to have that kind of confidence in terms of using it. But from a recruiting standpoint, I think that the business will be, you know, in order to operate these systems, the recruits you pull in, you will either have to develop their intellect in these areas, or you're getting a higher caliber recruit in that business. And maybe even the recruit's ability to do 50 push-ups may not be as important as that recruit's ability to think faster on their feet doing that. Now, I'm not against the 50 push-ups, I could be wrong, just a thought.
Reaching back to your first answer, a lot of our officers and enlisted today are reacting to certain policy reversals and changes within the DoD. What advice would you give our future leaders, either military or civilian, to maintain that sense of empathy and seeing each other for who we are, physical standards, mental standards aside, to do the jobs that we've been entrusted to do for our nation?
Well, I think the whole thing of leadership is leading your entire team in terms of things. I think, too, there's always the understanding of military works for our politicians. And we have to always keep that in mind in terms of everything we do, our elected officials accordingly. Third thing that I'll talk about, even though, you know, the word DEI may not be the acceptable term today, but if that term truly infuriates someone that's not in that category because they feel excluded, then we have to work so that we are inclusive in everything we do. So, you know, notice DEI has inclusive as that last I in that regard, but it still does not stop us from understanding the background, the journey that each individual has had to do to get to that point to even join the military and perform in the military. And then having the respect for each individual, regardless of where they are from, they raise their right hand to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. So whether they're Black, white, Indian, whatever that category is, male, female, et cetera, I feel as a leader, it's my job to advance their performance, all of them. Because as I have always said, I don't know who's going to save the day when flooding occurs in the torpedo room. If I'm operating on my submarine, I don't care what color, I don't care what gender, just so that person can operate the valves to isolate the system and correctly save the ship. That's what's important, and ensure that everything we do supports that. Now, I have mixed emotions over this. Well, let's not celebrate anything about diversity, because we are a diverse organization, whether we claim it or not. So we have to be very candid with that piece going forward. And I think we have to be careful in that. That may, in fact, ultimately get the wrong impression and cause retention to have some hiccups going forward. I don't know. We will see. Our history of America is built on so many different populations in terms of how we got to where we are today. So this business of we're all Americans, but we're all individually different in one way or the other. Celebrating the differences, I do not feel is wrong, as long as it's in balance with everything else we're doing. Because when it comes to combat, bullets fly, torpedoes, missiles, and what have you. And when they fly, they don't care what population it hits once it leaves the thing, and that, or if it's incoming. So we have to be ready as one team, one fight. I'm all about that piece. And I can truly say, as much as someone might point a finger and say, you have been in various diversity initiatives and what have you, well, I have mentored more majority officers and sailors, because that's what's in our Navy, in our military, than I have those that we would label as minorities. But I treated them all the same in terms of wanting them to be the best they could possibly be. And to me, that's what's important going forward.
I did not take JPME here at NPS. I took it through the Naval War College online. I remember one of our essay questions: should retired military officers be able to use their title, their rank that they earned in the military, in the civilian sector when they are giving advice? And it had a lot of pros and cons that we went through in class. And so I think it's really interesting, especially for you, sir, having attained 4 stars. How do you balance that? And what is prior military? What is my 4-star self saying? What is my civilian self saying? Or what is Mr. Haney saying?
Well, when I was blessed being in the military to get exposed to policy development, strategy development, working with our political apparatus hand in hand in that regard, I learned a lot through that experience. So as a retired military 4-star, I have in fact tried to connect myself to various roles that can use that expertise. Now, sometimes we see the retired military critiquing publicly X, Y, or Z associated with what an administration may be doing. I'm very cautious with that, and I'm not a big fan of critiquing. If there is a role to explain where we are, et cetera, because as a retired military guy, even though I may have still some roles that I do that require security clearances, I don't know everything that they know regarding the decisions that they are in. So I am not one that you ever see on CNN or one of those kind of things giving my opinion, because what they want is usually a rapid fire, quick answer, yes, no. Things are complicated. But where I have done is I've worked behind the scenes. For example, one of the first things I was involved with was the U.S.-China Dialogue for Nuclear Security Dynamics, where we twice a year met with the Chinese. And we had formal talks associated with strategic deterrence and how transparency and all that's very important in that regard. Since then, I've had 2 times where I have worked with the Department of State, for example. One was the International Security Advisory Board here that my service just wrapped up on. And that was one, instead of being visual on a camera kind of thing, to me, I feel I'm more valuable if I'm working with a State Department or what have you, and at least bringing my past experience to ensure that that awareness is understood, while also being respectful for what I may not understand that they're particularly dealing with. I think that's the true value of working in the military as a military retiree. I am not a big fan, to be honest with you, during political elections. as a military guy standing up and saying I'm for one candidate versus another any more than I was when I was in military. You know, wearing the uniform, that was not allowed. And I fully believe those views in terms of things can stain the military in a bad way in terms of assuming you're aligned. Those in uniform still are aligned to one party versus another party in that regard. Not against a military person running for office in any form or fashion. That's their constitutional right. And to me, that is applauded. Representative Don Bacon there in Nebraska, for example, was an individual I got to know some long time ago in that regard. And he's out there doing his best from what I can tell from afar. I don't vote for him because I don't live in his state. But to me, that's making a deliberate contribution in a very formal way, getting elected and then executing your policies and those kind of things and the responsibilities that you have. So I'm not big on advertisements. I'm big on rolling up the sleeves, getting in the policy work tanks and what have you, and providing your military advice, your strategic advice, your policy advice, and then letting them work through it. Recently, I was really excited about chairing a study in the International Security Advisory Board for state associated with biotechnology and that importance of that particular area for our nation and for the world, if, you know, that we need to get right going forward. So gave me great exposure. And quite frankly, it's not one that you saw me on any TV screen talking about, but, you know, that report's out there and available. So that's sort of my belief, my personal belief in terms of working that piece where I do have some friends that they feel their forte is being a spokesperson on one of the TV channels. Nothing wrong with that. That's just not my particular preference of operation because I don't like how a lot of the news just wants a yes, quick, no answer. Those that have a more comprehensive discussion, like I have participated in some of the think tank forums and what have you, but there you have more of an opportunity to voice the whole thing than some piece of thing that can be misinterpreted, taken out of contents, and what have you.
Well, sir, now that you've mentioned that you don't mind rolling up your sleeves and digging into the literature, is there a book in the works that we can just dive into leadership from Admiral Haney?
I'm often asked if I'm going to write a book.
I need to know now.
And, you know, currently I'm in this category where I feel I'm still learning buckets. I'm still reading a lot and encourage others to read a lot. In that regard, maybe someday I will work on a book, but there are a lot of great books. I tell folks that I mentor, I say, read three types of books. One associated with your own personal growth and leadership and that kind of thing, professional development. The second one is know your history as best you can. So read historical books. Notice I say books, not tweets, not short things. It's okay to read short articles and those kind of things to prime the pump, but you need to read more in depth. And then the third one is one that I'm a big fan of, to read science fiction, to think about the future and not be so locked in the past or what's occurring on today, so that as you talk about things, you can connect that dots to what the future may look like in that regard. So those are the things that I am excited about reading today, encouraging others to read today. And no, I haven't come up with my own book. There are lots of leadership books out there that are one.
Well, maybe the transcript of this podcast can serve as the launch point for your future book, sir. Any final remarks you'd like to leave us with, sir?
Well, my remarks really go out to those students and faculty that are here at this particular institution and even postgraduate school. My hat's off. I learned a lot here and it served me well, continues to serve me well, helped me not be afraid of technology. And that's a great blessing in terms of things. And as I've been around to see various parts of the research and studies that are going on here today, I am just so proud of this institution and what it's doing. And I'm proud of those members that continue to serve in our United States military.
Thank you, sir. And thank you so much for your time here today.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us in the Trident Room. For more information about today's guests and topics, please visit the show notes online at nps.edu/Trident Room Podcast. The Trident Room Podcast has been brought to you by the Naval Postgraduate School Alumni Association and Foundation. For questions, comments, and suggestions, please email us at TridentRoomPodcastHost@nps.edu.